Hey, I'm just letting you know that in February 2023, I am speaking at my friend Andy Storch's event in Sonoma, California. It's called the Talent Development Think Tank. I'll be running a session on marketing your workshops. And on day three, I'll be hosting the 2-hour workshop blueprint session. I'd love to see you there. Head on over to leannehughes.com/thinktank. Enjoy the episode. I'm your host, Leanne Hughes, and I'm here to help you imagine what's possible is possible for you.
Life's too short, so you're here to work and live large. Here's your host with nothing to lose, Leanne Hughes.
This is a very unique episode, and it's coming because I'm reading this book. I'm about 3/4 of the way in, and I'm loving it. I've just dogged so many pages, and I just want to tell everyone about it. So this is my way of doing that. No doubt if I'm catching up with you for a drink or a lunch or a coffee or a Zoom call, I will probably mention this book. So this isn't really a book review as such. I just want to share, I guess, some standout moments for me while reading this book. And the book is called Becoming Myself, A Psychiatrist's Memoir. It's by Irvin D. Yalom. I've got the book in front of me. I've got a hard copy of it. It's not on my Kindle. So like I said, yeah, I think many of these pages are dog-eared, and I think I'll come back with a highlighter. And that's actually why I'm here, because I wanted to set some time to reflect upon what I was reading. It's an interesting book because you want to reflect on what you're reading, that hence the dog-eared pages, but then you want to just keep turning the pages because it is written in such a beautiful and easy way. It's just a delight to read. I'm honestly loving going to bed early because I get to spend time with this book. How this happened was I spoke at an ICF, International Coaching Federation event for New South Wales a couple months ago. And this is a nice gesture. They gave me a $75 Booktopia gift voucher. And because it was like this bonus voucher, I wasn't expecting it. I thought I'd actually just go on and pick some random books to read that had just been top of mind for me that very day. What I usually tend to do is if someone gives me a book recommendation or hears something, I have something in my Apple phone, which is like in the notes section. And yeah, I've got a section there of books, but I didn't want to actually go through that list and buy things I'd already thought about. I just wanted to be like, right, today, what do I feel like? And the timing was really interesting because the night before I'd been at a 2-hour cocktail party hosted by my friend Ronsley. And I was talking about facilitation and consulting and the work that I did. And someone at that party was like, oh, have you heard of Irvin D. Yalom? You should really check out his work. I think you'd really like it. And the name, it kind of does sound familiar. I remember, I'm positive, as part of my psychology degree, I would have referenced or we would have talked about this guy, no doubt, because he's extremely prolific. And I feel a bit silly, like not knowing his name immediately when she mentioned it to him now, as I read this. So I bought his book, which is what I'm talking about today. I also bought The Bomber Mafia by Malcolm Gladwell, and then Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, because John McKendry, who has been on this podcast as a guest, recommended this book. And Tim Ferriss talks about it all the time, so it was time to get that. I did start reading Meditations, but it's a hard read. I think I've got to read it in the morning and not in the evening. But this book, oh my gosh, it's fantastic. So what I'm going to do is just share some of the pages that I've reflected on and highlighted. I think they're useful just if you're a human being, but also if you are working with groups. He talks about existentialism, about bringing and also the fact that we all die. But when I read it, that's really closely linked to the premise of this show, Work and Live Large, which is that, we have limited time on this earth. We have no idea how much time is promised to us. So let's get the best out of the time that we have here. And that is a real motivator for me that, across anything I do is particularly, and even with my work in facilitation is, how do we make these group experiences so memorable, so great, because we only have a limited amount of time on earth. So it comes from that place, which is, you could look at that as negative or positive, but and a lot of authors, Don Miller in his book, Hero on a Mission, the whole premise around that is like, write your obituary, start with that, and then re-engineer your life and your goals from that obituary. MBS in his book, How to Begin, talks about how he has something that shows how many weeks he's got left to live, like based on the average lifespan. What Irvin really talks about in his book is that a lot of the psychotherapy and sessions that he went to, therapy sessions, meetings with psychologists and psychiatrists, no one ever talked about the fear of death or dying as part of it. And this is what this guy really pioneered. So saying that, I'll give you a bit of biography on Irvin. So his name is Irvin David Yalom. He was born in 1931 in Washington, D.C., MD, and he's an author of fiction and nonfiction. He's also the Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry at Stanford University, an existentialist and accomplished psychotherapist. I'm learning a lot about the author because I am reading his memoir. So what he talks about is growing up in Washington, D.C. His parents emigrated from Russia, and he spent a lot of the time in his childhood reading books. Then he studied medicine and became really drawn to the science. But what he realized later on is that he learned more about the work that he did in psychiatry, not through medicine and the science of it, but through the authors that he read and the humanities subjects. I'll grab this from Wikipedia, just, and I won't read all of it, but just a few sort of snapshots so you can gain a bit of a perspective on who this guy is, who the author is. Irvin's writing on existential psychology centers on what he refers to as the four givens of the human condition: isolation, meaninglessness, mortality, and freedom. And he discusses ways in which the human person can respond to these concerns either in a functional or dysfunctional fashion. The isolation, I'll just center on that because I read recently on what he meant by that, is the fact that we are born into this world by ourselves and we die by ourselves. And so you can see the tension that creates in our lives. And yes, I'm going to stop waffling now and I'll read some of the insights that I've brought in. So starting from the power of groups, he's so well read. He just links in these beautiful sayings and tales. So here's one that he shares about the power of group dynamics. It's an old Hasidic tale. I'll read it for you right now. A rabbi had a conversation with the Lord about heaven and hell. "I will show you hell," said the Lord. And he led the rabbi into a room containing a large round table. The people sitting around the table were famished and desperate. In the middle of the table was an enormous pot of stew that smelled so delicious that the rabbi's mouth watered. Each person around the table held a spoon with a very long handle. Although the long spoons just reached the pot, their handles were longer than the would-be diner's arms. Thus, they were unable to bring food to their lips. No one could eat. The rabbi saw that their suffering was terrible indeed. "Now I will show you heaven," said the Lord. And they went into another room, exactly the same as the first. There was the same large round table, the same pot of stew. The people were equipped with the same long-handled spoons. But here, everyone was well-nourished and plump, laughing and talking. The rabbi could not understand. "It is simple, but it requires a certain skill," said the Lord. "In this room, you see, they have learned to feed each other." And the reason Irv shares this is because he spoke about the power of groups in healing for group therapy. And in this particular example on page 184, he's sharing about how he started a group for people that had terminal illness. One example that follows this is he thinks of a woman who came week after week with such a weary, despondent look in her eyes, and the group struggled in vain to offer her solace. Then suddenly one day she shows up with a spark in her eyes and wearing a bright colored dress. She thanked us and said that the group discussion the week prior had helped her make a pivotal decision. She had decided she could model to her children how to face death with grace and courage. And in this, Irv says he's never encountered a better example of how a sense of meaning in life generates a sense of well-being. A sense of meaning in life generates a sense of well-being. Such a great example. And look, I feel really a little bit silly drawing my own experience to this very powerful one in terms of working with groups around terminal illness and what he's learned as a result. But I've also, just my own experience working one-on-one with coaches, I find I just gain so much more by being part of a group because of the varying dynamics that are at play. And just raising that consciousness and awareness of fellow group members and peers asking questions that I've never even considered before. I think there's the real value is that you get this just incredible watershed moment from all these different angles. Now that links, I think, very nicely, well, into Irv's insight in 1964. So he was 3 years into his career at Stanford and he decided to attend an 8-day National Training Laboratory Institute session in Southern California. And he was most looking forward to having a session where for every day, for 3 hours, they just meet up as a group. Now, it was run and I'm not going to talk about this aspect, but run in a really interesting way where the leader really didn't lead at all. And it was the first time, and this is what I want to share, Irv had the insight that in the group they were meeting in, where they had 11 people sitting around in a circle with one supposed leader, he said the group members were being exposed to a single stimulus, in this instance, a leader asking that all comments remain in the here and now. And the members responded in very different ways. A single shared stimulus and 11 different responses? Why? There was only one possible solution to this puzzle. There are 11 different inner worlds. And these 11 different responses may be the royal road into these different worlds. So from that insight, I think that's also why I love the group dynamic. It doesn't matter who you have in your group, is that each person coming into that setting is coming in from their own world, and their reaction to something, to a stimulus, to a question, to a response, to anything really that's happening, is it gives you a lens into what that person's life might look like for them. And that's why I think group work is so powerful, hence the facilitation podcast, hence why I love having these group meetings. And I think we really tend to undervalue. I think one-to-one programs, one-to-one coaching seems like the more prestigious item because you're getting direct attention. I just don't think, honestly, for me, throw me into a group setting. And Irv actually even says here his perfect group numbers are between 6 to 8 members because of that dynamic. And I absolutely agree, just not from no science, but I'm happy it's been verified by Irv in this, but just from a feel of what it even feels like. And I'm talking in both in-person and virtual calls as well. Okay, on page 128, I want to just share this example as how bold Irvin was. So he ran these group therapy sessions, and then after the session, he dictated extensive summaries for his own understanding and his teaching, right? So he had a secretary at Stanford. So he'd have a group meeting, he'd go back, he'd dictate what his reflections were, things that he wished he could have said, things that maybe he regretted saying, or just things that he was thinking, right? So very transparent, noted them down. I think this is great practice wherever you are. Yeah, and there's an opportunity to always learn and reflect from the experiences that you deliver. So that's great. But this is the bold part, is that if he was meeting up with the group the following week or even 2 weeks, like whenever he was meeting up with the group next, he would get that transcript of what he dictated and actually send it to the group the day before the session. Okay. So he would tell them like everything that he was thinking, his observations, no matter how transparent, and he'd send that to the group the day before the session. They'd have time to review it. And then the next time they met up, so the following day, they began the session by critiquing his summary of the previous meeting. And I love he says here, sometimes members disagreed, sometimes they pointed out omissions, but almost always the meeting began with more energy and interaction than it had before. Irv found this practice to be so useful that he continued these summaries as long as he led groups. He writes, I cannot recall a single instance in which sharing my thoughts and my personal feelings was not helpful to the patient. And he writes, why did self-exposure come so easily to me? For one thing, I had chosen not to enroll in any postgraduate training, no Freudian or Jungian analytic institutes. I was entirely free of governing rules and was guided only by my results, which I carefully monitored. A number of issues may have been at play. My ingrained iconoclasm, evident in my early responses to religious belief and ritual. My negative personal experience in analysis with an inexpressive and impersonal analyst. And the experiential atmosphere in my young department overseen by my open-minded chairman. So he had that support through his environment. He's had a history of sort of questioning things, but also like not being institutionalized, I think, also gave him the freedom to think of it differently and be very brave in sharing those opinions. So I think that's awesome. I love that share. And I would love to be bold enough to try that in any group sessions that I deliver. Page 145, this isn't really much so much a share, but just a really cool quote I wanted to highlight for you when it comes to resistance. This is when Irv was living in London and he was consulted with the head of the Kleinian Analytic School over there. And they had a 2-hour consultation. Irv was very skeptical of the approach. And the head of the school said, as he put it, the volume of your background music will obscure the true chords of the analysis. I love that line. So all this stuff that's going on in our mind that we can't actually be open to hearing maybe new opinions. I think if you're talking about change or overcoming resistance, I think that's a really cool line. So I just wanted to, again, highlight that. And finally, one more. As I said earlier, Irv talks about 4 different concerns, and the 4th one is meaninglessness. So this touches on questions like, why were we put here on earth? If nothing endures, what sense does life have? What is the point of life? So this is really about purpose. purposes on one end, meaninglessness on the other. And Irv shares that he's always been moved by Alan Wheeler's account of throwing a stick for his dog, Monty, to retrieve. And I wanted to sort of end the episode with this excerpt. "If then I bend over and pick up a stick, he is instantly before me. The great thing has now happened. He has a mission. It never occurs to him to evaluate the mission. His dedication is solely to its fulfillment. He runs or swims any distance, over or through any obstacle, to get that stick. And having got it, he brings it back, for his mission is not simply to get it, but to return it. Yet as he approaches me, he moves more slowly. He wants to give it to me and give closure to his task. Yet he hates to have done with his mission, to again be in the position of waiting. He is lucky to have me throw his stick. I am waiting for God to throw mine. Have been waiting a long time. Who knows when, if ever, he will again turn his attention to me and allow me, as I allow Monty, my mood of mission." Irv then sums this up by saying, "It is reassuring to believe that God has a purpose for us. Secular people find it discomforting to know that they must throw their own sticks. How reassuring it would be to know that somewhere out there exists a genuine, palpable purpose in life rather than only the sense of purpose in life." Ovid's comments come to mind. "It's useful that there should be gods, so let's believe there are." So I've just pulled out just four or five random things that have struck me as I've read this book, but every page there is something of just value. It's entertaining. I just wanted to share some of the highlights from this book with you. It's really, really made me think. The book again is Becoming Myself, A Psychiatrist's Memoir by Irvin D. Yalom, and you can find his work over at yalom.com. Let me know what you thought of this type of episode. If anything in this episode spoke to you or stood out, let me know. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me hello@leannehughes.com or connect on any of the socials. Chat to you next time. You're the best. Thank you so much for tuning in to Work and Live Large. I really appreciate you. If you know someone in your network and you think, oh my gosh, they've got so much potential, like I want them to live and work larger, send them this episode. I think they might appreciate it. I also appreciate hearing from you, your feedback, your thoughts, your questions, anything. You can shoot me an email, hello@leannehughes.com, or find me on LinkedIn, just search for Leanne Hughes. Stay up to date with all the episodes by heading on over to leannehughes.com/subscribe, and all the best with your week as you go around living it up.